Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm an open book. I ain't got no secrets. My story bleeds poetic lines.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. These days, R&B singer Betty LaVette is an open book. Her new memoir is called A Woman Like Me, and it is a brutally honest take on her life in music over the past 50 years, from her first single in 1962 to run-ins with pimps and producers through a 20-year struggle to get her first album released. Speaking of which, the Detroit native also has a new album out. It's called Thankful and Thoughtful, and it includes this song. Betty LaVette, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, John. Thank you.
So this really is kind of par for the course for you. I mean, you've sung about your career and about, you know, people and the kind of the trials and tribulations that you've gone through. Mm-hmm. So was this, I mean, you know, you take a song like Before the Money Came, The Battle of Betty LaVette. Is this book kind of that story, kind of writ large?
I think so. You have to realize, John, just before 8 or 9 years ago, these stories were all I had. All of my friends and neighbors had become stars and millionaires, and I would, just to make myself a part of what happened, I'd say, well, one time Martha Reeves and I did this, or one time this happened. So I only had these stories before now. And in doing the book with David Ritz, it was so funny because I've always kind of told the part of the story that would get your attention at dinner or wherever, and everybody would chuckle, and then that would be it. But in writing the book, which turned out to be more than conversational, mm-hmm, I would make a statement, and David Ritz would say, who? And I would say, who? And he'd say, and what were you doing when this happened? So I had to flesh the whole thing out a little more than I ever had before.
And those memories were still there?
Well, that was all I had to think about. Yeah. You know, I mean, a whole bunch of other things didn't happen to me, so I didn't have a whole bunch to dwell on.
We're speaking with Betty LaVette. Here is the song Before the Money Came, subtitled Battle of Betty LaVette. This is from the 2007 record Scene of the Crime.
Before the money came,
I was singing R&B back in 62, before you were born and your mama too. I knew David Ruff when he was over, sleeping on my floor before he crossed over. All my friends on the Grammy show. I was stuck in Detroit trying to open doors. Record deals kept falling apart. One with Atlantic nearly blew my heart. Before the money came, I got a lot to say. So proud I was built this way. Some folks didn't see my worth, didn't know where I fit in. 40 years I kept on singing.
Before the Money Came, subtitled The Battle of Betty LaVette. That's from Betty's 2007 album, Scene of the Crime, a song co-written with Patterson Hood from the Drive-By Truckers.
Yes.
So, I mean, without skipping over your whole life story and getting to the end of the book, I mean, eventually you find yourself working with lots of people that growing up, you know, was not necessarily your kind of genre, you know? So there's the covers record of, like, British rock songs.
If you look at everything I've ever recorded, I've always done these kinds of tunes. I did What Condition My Condition Is In. I did, on my live show, I was doing all the Beatles tunes. It's just that no one was willing to let me, very few people were willing to let me record this at length. Mm-hmm. You know, they would hear one that they liked, but nobody would ever let me do what I'm doing now.
And what you're doing now is not just a series of great records, but again, this biography that you've co-written with David Ritz called A Woman Like Me. And man, you know, there are biographies that have great opening lines. Keith Richards' life begins with a wonderful story. But nothing like this, where where we are not sure, Betty, if you are going to survive the first page of your own memoir.
My publicist said she was trying to read it in bed, and she was saying, Betty, no! And her husband said, you're going to have to go in the living room and read that.
So, line one, a vicious pimp was precariously holding on to my right foot as he dangled me from the top of a 20-story apartment building. You just jump right in.
Tell us what happened.
That vicious pimp is actually one of the few names in the book that you don't name. Mm-hmm. We just know him as Jay later on.
We figured if he still is alive, he'd definitely sue everyone I've ever met.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you get to that point? Because by this point, you had already had a hit single in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. How did you get to that point where you found your life being jeopardized by this guy from the streets
of
New York?
The career thing had really kind of fallen apart, or was slowly falling apart. And I think he probably knew that and saw that I would be helpless when it came apart, because it was all, when you're leaning on a record, which is what I tell young people now, you have to be able to lean on more than just the record. Even the record sells 20 million copies. At some point, it's going to stop selling. Mm-hmm. And when mine stopped selling, he was like there to help me up. And it was then when I lost my apartment, he was there to help me again. And then when I didn't get another gig, he was there to help me again. And, you know, after several months went by, he was like, well, now, how do you intend to pay all this money back? Mm. And I was stunned, because I thought we were a couple, and while, you know, he insisted that whatever money I made, I would give it to him, but it was more he was in charge of the money rather than give me your money. Mm-hmm. It was our money and he was in charge of it. But then when I wasn't making any more, it was like, well, how do you intend to pay for all this rent and all this food you've had and clothes you've had to buy? And maybe I would need an outfit to go for a new record trial or audition or whatever. And so it kind of happened like that. It wasn't where he just cruised up and said, here, stop singing, and come and be with me. It wasn't like that. It was almost like a blackmailish kind of thing,
right?
A vicious blackmail kind of thing.
Well, early on in the book, when you talk about your early days in Detroit, it struck me that, the thin line between pimps and producers, mm-hmm, in the Detroit music scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, we sort of laugh and say, yeah, it was a man's world, but there's no laughing
really
matter.
It really was really kind of popular at one point. The bigger pimps throughout the country had the bigger singers, and it wasn't looked upon as it's looked upon now. It was just as bad, but it just wasn't looked at as being as bad. And these people weren't trying to make us do anything other than sing. They just wanted the money when we sung or, mm-hmm, if we sung. And at one point in there, we're talking about Aretha Franklin, and it says that I had an affair with her husband. I don't know anything about him being her husband. I only know about him being a pimp, which everybody knew. I probably had to get more people to give me letters of verification on that than anything, because his life has certainly changed. And that certainly isn't what he is now, but that's what he was then. Mm. And everybody knew it. And he attested to it and said it out loud himself.
Now, this 1962, I mean, it seemed like you were on the road. You had this hit single, My Man, He's a Lovin' Man. How did that happen?
Well, in Detroit in 1962, it was no big deal to record. Just like My Bad Luck, it happens vicariously, and this did as well. It was no problem to record in Detroit, but to wind up on a label as big as Atlantic just happened because the person I recorded for happened to be with the Falcons, who had just said, I found a love with Atlantic. So they already had a working relationship with Jerry Wexler and Ahmet Ertegun. So
the two heads of Atlantic, mm-hmm, Records.
So here, let me let you hear this one by a young girl, Betty LeVette. Would you listen to it? And they did, and Jerry Wexler liked it and bought it right on the spot. So while I recorded the song for a small label in Detroit, when it came out on the Atlantic record label, and people say, were you very upset about not being with Motown? And I always say, no, Berry Gordy wanted to be with Atlantic in 1962. Mm-hmm. Maybe not in 1964, but in 1962 he did.
And you were, and this is what it sounded like. Betty LeVette's 1962 single, My Man, He's a Lovin' Man. 1962 single from Betty LeVette, My Man, He's a Lovin' Man. So you were already Betty LeVette by then. You had taken the name.
No, I wasn't Betty LeVette.
Okay.
Yet.
So you were still...
No, when the record came out, all of 10 days, maybe 8 days. So in that week, I became Betty LeVette. I became a recording artist, and I held a microphone for the very first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I had not done any of this. All the only thing I had done before this was the work you're doing in ninth grade.
How old were you when that
song? I was 16 by the time it came out. I guess I had been out of school maybe 9 months. I had left at 15, but then came back and went back. And when the record came out, of course, this is who I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. No more school.
And the name LeVette, you basically got it from another singer, right?
No, I got it from a groupie.
A groupie?
Who introduced me to everybody in Detroit. She knew all the pimps. She knew everyone within El Dorado. All the pimps, all the singers. She knew their license plate numbers. I meant she knew every one of them, everybody black who had a record out. Mm-hmm. And she was introducing them to me and saying, she can sing, you should hear her sing. And, you know, it was kind of like, you know, well, you know, I was with her, so. But then somebody, she said that too, said, well, let me hear her. And I sung a song and they said, yeah, you can sing.
And you liked the name LeVette, and she said, take it.
Yeah, her name was Sharma LeVette. Mm-hmm. LeVette was her middle name.
We're speaking with Betty LeVette. Her book is called A Woman Like Me. It's a biography, autobiography, co-written with David Ritz. And she's with us on Soundcheck today. Now, you mentioned the song came out on Atlantic. Jerry Wexler, Ahmet Erdogan. Ahmet seems to have, at least in early days, not have had a whole lot to say to you. But Jerry Wexler, I mean, first of all, there's like a dizzying parade of men through this book. It was very hard to keep up, although certain names keep coming up who were obviously very important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Wexler, early on in your career, is trying to fix you up with a young songwriter named Burt Bacharach, and you're not having any of it.
No, because, I mean, I know he had even Walk On By. And anyone who had a heart, I think he had had maybe two things on Dion. But Lieber and Stoller had everything I had heard all of my life. They had recorded everybody I loved, everybody I admired, every song I knew. I got kicked out of school singing one of their songs in a talent show. So I loved them, but they had just left Atlantic at the very same time that I...
Right. But Jerry Wexler then says he's going to write you a $500 check because if you're leaving, he wants you to have something to kind of...
Because it's apparent you're stupid, so...
Well, now, you refer to buzzard luck several times during the course of the book, and, you know, a lot of people have heard these stories of, you know, an album gets recorded and then the producer is fired or the label goes under, so... But at some point, do you think of... For example, the Jerry Wexler, Burt Bacharach conversation and say to yourself, you know, gosh, I wish I had actually done that one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. That was my first business decision made alone and the worst business decision I ever made in my life. Even just sitting there, Jerry probably would not have let me starve. He probably would have written me another $500 check, you know, just as he later did for my producer, Ollie McLaughlin. Every time he got broke, he wrote him a check. But and I'm sure that they would have been willing to do that. And I would only after I left Atlantic, I would call him and say, would you send me $50 or just send me $75 or whatever? And he would.
Now, how old were you when you made that decision? And why were you making the decision without like an agent or a lawyer or a manager?
Well, my manager had been shot, which is why I was in New York. And I figured while I was there, I would go and handle this business. And my manager had been shot by Mary Wells' husband, Mary Wells, who was the biggest black rhythm and blues singer of the day. You know, so when you say buzzard luck, the things that have happened to me have been just so different than any of the bad things that have happened to anyone else, you know.
Yeah. And it's been one thing after another. And then comes the British invasion in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of American ears are suddenly, you know, facing the other side of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And that, what did that do to, you know, to your career, to your ability to make a career in the 70s?
Well, it probably hindered it because I was far down on the recording chain. but impaired the other artist who was still living in Detroit, who was still my friends, who were doing well, who gave me money and drugs and whatever else. It impaired their careers, which was a definite infringement on my livelihood.
Right. So that pipeline was beginning to dry up a
absolutely,
little.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So this makes the irony even more delicious, that the song that brings you to the Kennedy Center Honors and puts you on national TV and puts you in front of the glitterati of American society is a song from The Who.
It's a pretty song. I love it. And then, you know, my husband was one of those young white kids in the 60s and 70s who worshiped these people and still does. And so that moment, that Sunday morning, to be looking up at Pete Townsend, who was sitting right next to Barbara Streisand, whose success happened at the same time mine did, except that hers went on, mine didn't. And then Aretha was sitting on the lower floor right directly in front of me. And then across from her was sitting Beyonce. I call it my Three Stooges slap.
It apparently brought the house down. You're right, Pete Townsend was visibly crying while you sang his song.
So that was good for my husband to see.
And how did that feel?
I'm telling you, that was good for it was good seeing my husband see that.
Mm.
You know, it's like there's nothing, I will never be able to sell as many records as these people have. I would never be able to have as many people in my audience. I just don't even have that kind of time. If everything went right from now on, I just don't have that kind of time. But I did have that moment.
That moment, the Kennedy Center Honors in Washington, D.C., 2008, when my guest Betty LeVette sang The Who's Love, Rain or Me, later included on the 2010 collection Interpretations, the British Rock Songbook. Recorded live at the Kennedy Center Honors in 2008 and then included 2 years later on her record Interpretations, that is Betty LeVette, my guest on Soundcheck today with her version of The Who's Love, Rain or Me. And her book is called Betty LeVette, A Woman Like Me. That is one hell of a lived-in voice. I mean, and you can take that however you want, but
No, I take it as a compliment. Yeah. I really do.
So how... I mean, through a life and a career that has been turbulent, that has seen its share of drugs and alcohol and abuse and stuff, how have you kept that instrument? You know, how have you taken care of that instrument?
People assume that because I took some drugs, I abused them. I never had enough money to abuse drugs. And I have always liked singing better than I do anything. I can only be so drunk, which is about the only thing that I do now, to stand up on 6-inch heels or 5-inch heels and dance back and forth across the stage. I can only smoke so much marijuana, or none at all, when I'm performing because it dries your throat up.
Mm-hmm.
And I sing too hard, so I just wouldn't be able to do it. And the other stuff, one of the first things I was taught by all of these pimps and drug dealers was the difference between cocaine and heroin. And I learned never to touch the heroin. And the cocaine just really, I never found it that fascinating. It was just so popular at one point. Everywhere I went, it was there. It was there. I blew it, but never bought any, never had any.
Hmm.
But if it was there, I have sat and blown it for 2 or 3 days. But when I went home, it was over.
And, you know, would you have periods where, you know, you would really start worrying about what am I doing to, you know, to my voice?
No, because I didn't have any job and I didn't have any cocaine. So there was nothing to worry about.
The story is such a roller coaster because every time it seems like you've hit a wall, hit a dead end, there would come this opportunity. And you know, the 20-year wait to do your first record. And when the record comes out, it's a different woman's picture on the cover.
Can you stand that?
I still don't quite understand. I know you try and you make an attempt to recount the record company's explanation
that
for how this happened.
That is what they told me, which is the most ridiculous answer I've ever heard in my life, considering.
But, you know, with all of the stuff that you write in the book, perhaps the most provocative thing that you say is about how men have traditionally treated women. You know, you talk about Aretha getting slapped around by her husband, you getting beaten up by some of your boyfriends. Ike and Tina, you know, the fact that Tina Turner wouldn't have been Tina Turner, wouldn't have been rich if it wasn't for Ike, and that, you know, the way Hollywood portrayed Ike Turner was sort of unfair and stuff. Have you gotten a lot of pushback from that?
No, I think that I get more because Tina and Diana so greatly love and so deservedly so, and I understand why they are. But the only thing that I really was saying in terms of Tina, I didn't think that any of the people were right for hitting any of us. But Tina, the only thing I said about Tina was that she could have left at any time she wanted because she was so loved and so desired by so many men of all ilk and run of life. So that could have been done. But in terms of her, I felt, and most musicians feel, that Ike was much more talented than she, and because he was, just as Jim was much more talented than me, and that was why he was able to, he wasn't as cute and didn't look the same way on stage, so he was able to give me everything that he knew. And that was just what Ike did, although I'm sure that Ike had such an attitude, he probably felt he was as cute as Tina. Mm-hmm. But he taught her everything that he knew. And she's very soft-spoken, very bashful. I don't think she would have left home, pulled her dress over her head, and screamed and hollered like that with no provoking whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned Jim, by the way, I alluded before to
Jim Lewis.
Right, to several of the men who actually came into your life and stayed. And Jim Lewis was sort of your mentor, sort of played lots of different types of music for you, telling you
if
you could sing jazz, you could sing anything.
Yes,
which turned out to stand you in very good stead.
Yes. He told me you may never be a star, but if you will learn a lot of songs, learn how to sing them, you can sing the rest of your life. As long as you can sing, you can sing.
Now, and then at another point, much later in the book, someone, and I forget who it is, asks you if you're going to write a song, you know, for one of your more recent albums, and you say, I don't write songs, I interpret them. Mm-hmm. Have you never wanted to write your own songs?
Yes, I want to write. I want to play piano too, but I don't know how to do either one. You know, when I think of something to write, I write it. Mm-hmm. You know, but I just know that another song should have come to my head since before the money came, if I were a real writer. You know, and then just to force it because I can make some songs rhyme. I don't even want to become famous for writing shoddy little songs that just sell in a weak market like we have right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, your most recent record is called Thankful and Thoughtful. Now, you were saying before, and you're writing about all these people in the past, Diana Ross, Aretha, whoever, that they're not the same people now. You're a different person now from the 16-year-old, the 19-year-old who made that fateful decision.
I'm James and Marissa's grandmother now and Kevin's wife. And the oldster who's bringing up the rear, you know. So I don't even have the energy to be who I used to be. Mm.
So is Thankful and Thoughtful more than just a title for you?
Oh, I'm Thankful, Thoughtful, and Stunned should have been it. You couldn't have told me I was ever going to have another record contract at 55 years old for a guy who's the same age as my daughter to say, we'd like to do a record on you. I'm stunned. Mm-hmm. And the book is just overwhelming. This is just almost unreal. This is just almost unreal.
And you open that book up, and there among the pictures, you and Barack Obama, a grinning Barack
Isn't
Obama,
incredible?
Who is clearly, you know, completely thrilled to be
Isn't
standing next
incredible?
To you. Yeah, it is.
I am the people, especially like Mother Ernesta, whomever said she's never going to be anything. I am just as stunned as they are.
Betty LeVette, the book is called A Woman Like Me. It is... You can't take your eyes off the page. I mean, you never know what's going to come up next. Betty, it's been a real pleasure having you with us on Soundcheck
John, thanks
today.
So much for talking with me.
Here is a little bit from that album, the new album called Thankful and Thoughtful.
Should have been happy, Lord, not still be there. Some could have come along and taken me away. But the powers that be said I should have another day, and that's why I'm so thankful.